treating the world's resources as something that we must use as quickly as possible in order to have as rapid economic development as possible has put an enormous strain on these resources. As you point out, we've essentially poisoned the oceans. We have taken down the lungs of the planet, the trees that provide us with the oxygen that's necessary, both in developed countries, but even more critically in areas like the Amazon. We have, with pollution of the air, pollution of the soil, endangered the food production that we rely upon. And again, we think that with a kind of technical fix, another green revolution, for instance, we'll be able to boost food production to meet the growing needs of our growing population. But fundamentally, we're exhausting these resources, exhausting the waters, exhausting the soil.
John Pfeffer, before we get into the how these ideas have developed and the extent to which it's influenced by the profit considerations of the corporate elite, let's talk about the other kinds of events that you've written about, that it's not the long-term mass death and poisoning of the planet, but just the lack of maintenance and regulation of the whole set of sort of industrial facilities and other kinds in the United States, many of which are now enormously dangerous.
Let's start with the nuclear industry. This is a particularly critical industry because many people look to nuclear power as the key alternative to fossil fuels. It's somehow through a rejuvenation of the nuclear industry we'll be able to solve the climate change problem and provide the kind of energy we need for continued economic growth. I don't want to address that particular question yet, but I do want to point out that the nuclear industry produces an enormous amount of nuclear waste. There have been various plans to send this waste out to very faraway galaxies or burying it deep, deep, deep in salt mines. But at the moment, what we have are these basically holding facilities for nuclear waste in the United States, which are not secure by any stretch of the imagination. When we think about what happened in Fukushima in Japan, where this typhoon wave and earthquake basically sent the nuclear facility into meltdown mode, we have that here in the United States. We have these nuclear holding tanks of nuclear material, which are basically, some of them are near fault lines for earthquakes. They're not at all secure. A very extreme weather event could rip off the top and send that nuclear waste all over the place. Extremely dangerous situation, and it doesn't even cost that much to secure those containers. Now, the other question is, how do we deal with this on the long term? Because we continue to produce more nuclear material, and the Obama administration has, in fact, subsidized or is in the process of subsidizing another generation of nuclear facilities. And it also doesn't even address the question of nuclear accident at a facility itself. The risk of that also is present. So here we have a very vulnerable element of our infrastructure, both the nuclear facilities themselves, but also the facilities that have been developed to handle the enormous amount of waste that's produced by those facilities.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. It's a web magazine sponsored by the Institute for Policy Studies. Mostly foreign policy issues. We're talking today about the homegrown threats. There's also all of these oil pipelines, the gas pipelines, that there's occasional explosions killing 30, 50 people around the United States, crumbling infrastructure, right? Dams could give way, and some of them have. Even the great landslide we just had in the Northwest. It seems to me that many of our functioning systems are now dilapidated for lack of maintenance and upkeep and renewal.
Yeah, it's something that I think everybody in the United States has a story about in their own locality, about some piece of infrastructure that's collapsed. It might be a bridge that's collapsed. It might be a pipeline that ruptured. It might be a spill of chemicals into their water system. This affects all of us. And we might think, oh, well, this is just an exception. It's too bad it happened here. But actually, it's happening everywhere. Our infrastructure in the United States, because we have not invested in it, is crumbling. Every year, there's a report That comes from the American Society of Civil Engineers. They do a report card for America's infrastructure. And for the last few years, frankly, the grade has been pretty poor. Last year, it was a D+. These are the folks who know a great deal about infrastructure. These are the folks who designed much of this infrastructure. And the bottom line is that our budget priorities here in the United States have been such that we are just not putting our money where it counts. We're not putting the money into the infrastructure that sustains our society. And this is something that is a question at the federal level, with our federal budget priorities, with the enormous amount of money that we're putting into the military rather than the domestic infrastructure. But it's also at a state level, because so many states have been robbed of their resources, either because of poor tax decisions or because of a failure of the feds to provide money at a state level. And so at a state level, too, we see this infrastructure gap. In other words, a gap between what we need in order to have a healthy, functioning society that we all depend on, individuals, businesses, communities, and so forth, a gap between what we need and, frankly, what we have, which is crumbling.
That isn't just going to cause retail deaths, like when a dam fails, but that's also undermining the agricultural economy. And water, of course, is essential. Clean water is the reason we're living much longer lives. It's not the medical system that does that. It's basically hygiene, social hygiene, and sufficient calories. It seems to me that the way they're allowing infrastructure to degrade is also going to enormously reduce agricultural productivity, and climate change will, of course, do the same. John Pfeffer, as you pointed out, it's all well known. They've written about it. It's written about in a lot of places. Climate change, it's very clear. The scientists tell us what's happening, that it's a very high probability of temperatures rising to points where it's going to be very difficult to maintain large populations of people. Why, in fact, are these warnings being ignored? Why do at least our elites take out insurance to make sure their homes don't burn, even though their home is very unlikely to burn down, or their plant? They take out insurance, but here we have this existential threat, and they are not taking out insurance. What's going on?
Well, you know, I live here in Washington, D.C., and you know, I can tell you that there aren't lobbyists down on K Street who are hired by the community or the citizens who are worried about climate change. There are almost no lobbyists who are going out there in favor of more inspections of critical infrastructure. There are really no lobbyists in there saying, hey, we need more clean water. We have to worry about this threat. The lobby interests here in Washington are about big business making profits, not only here, but more importantly overseas. We have an enormous military manufacturing sector that has enormous lobbying that says, hey, you know, we need to continue to put, you know, the lion's share of our discretionary funding into the Pentagon. So when it comes down to time to vote on these issues, our politicians are going to be listening to the people who are paying for their reelection. And we don't have this kind of countervailing pressure coming from basically public interest. We have only a handful of public interest lobbyists or public interest lawyers who are working on our behalf. So I think that's the major reason why, at least in Washington, the attention is not being paid where it should be paid. I mean, if you look at the scale of the threat, any reasonable person would say, look, we had an Apollo program in which we poured enormous amounts of resources into getting spaceships up there to the moon and having men walk on the moon. And yet, when we look at the infrastructure here in the United States and the obvious need for a similar Apollo program just to get our country up and functioning again, it would seem to be a no-brainer. And it would also seem to be a no-brainer from the point of view of an economic stimulus for the economy, because this would be a job creator, would help business, especially small business, but not only small business. And yet, even though it seems to be a no-brainer, politically it is dead in the water because it does not have the support of lobbying interests.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mold talking to John Pfeffer. who writes on foreign policy, and he also writes about the great threats of mass death and the degradation of our society due to our homegrown interests who are undermining the ecosystems and, in fact, the productive systems that provide for human life. John Pfeffer, it seems to me that there actually are a lot of movements, movements in the United States that are, in fact, trying to address these issues. On the other hand, there's a lot of knowledge that we're moving on a path that's unsustainable. At some point, people are going to wake up. There's going to be an accumulation of threats, some dramatic events, and people will wake up and there'll be powerful movements for reorienting and redeploying all of our national resources. Why don't you comment on that hypothesis? And then how do you see those movements strengthening themselves right now, even though, of course, the Washington, D.C. and most of the state legislatures are, in fact, controlled by the corporate elites of their areas?
There definitely are strong movements, not just, of course, here in the United States, but worldwide, that are saying, hey, we've got to pay attention to the real threats. We've been focused on the so-called threat of terrorism for, you know, more than a decade now. But the real threat is around us, and it is climate change. It is the threat of global economic inequality. It is the threat still of nuclear annihilation, with still a huge number of nuclear weapons facing one another across national borders. Yes, absolutely. There are these movements. But I think one of the profound problems here in the United States in particular, but not just, is a loss of faith that government is part of the solution. So many people in the United States support the kind of political parties that have a single message, and that message is government is bad. Government is not part of the answer. And as long as we have that mentality, we're going to continue to see the deterioration of public infrastructure, because who supports public infrastructure? Government does, and government is our representative, democratic representatives. So until we change that particular mentality, we will not have a strong vehicle, a strong mechanism deploying the resources we need in the way that we need them.
Yeah, it does seem to me that we have to regain confidence in public action and in collaborative, collective action. And of course, there's a question of how to do that. It seems to me that people are of two minds on the question of whether the public can do things. On the one hand, they hear constantly that corporations and private enterprise, they're efficient and capable and run things well, and the public is wasteful and the rest. Let's say, for example, in the schools, we're always hearing the schools are broken and collapsing and the rest of it. And yet people around the schools, and I think in other areas as well, they know that their local teachers and their local schools are pretty good, and they defend them. And people in the suburbs, of course, don't want to give money to the national government, but they recognize that we have to spend public resources. They lavish money on their schools, many suburbs, on their public schools, and on their public parks. The attack on government is successful, of course, and people are very suspicious and cynical and don't believe the government can do anything. And yet in their own lives and in their own areas, they recognize they have to have a decent, honest, effective government. And most of the time they get it, actually, and are appreciative of it. So it seems to me that that battle is not lost, that there's a capacity for people to understand that. Why don't you take the last word on that's my hypothesis.
I do think that people are of two minds when it comes to public goods. They recognize, especially when prompted, that so much of their life depends on the proper functioning of public goods, whether it's the train they commute in, the road they drive on, the airplane they take to far-off locations, the utilities that they depend on, the educational system. I mean, on and on. We are enormously dependent on these public institutions. I think the key is accountability. If people feel in some ways that the institutions are accountable, then they have more faith in them. Then, of course, because they are closer to local institutions, closer perhaps to state institutions, there is that sense of accountability, although not always. Federal government, further away, they have less of a sense of accountability, especially if they are bombarded with messages all the time that, again, federal government is part of the problem, not part of the solution. I'm not saying that any government is going to be, you know, the proper mechanism for addressing these major life-threatening situations that we face. It has to be a democratic system that's accountable, that there's a measure of transparency. That's something that we as citizens have to become involved ensuring. When we as citizens begin to see government as something apart from us rather than something that is created by us, that's when I think the distance grows between us and the institutions that are supposedly representing us. But I do not see any other method of addressing these huge, massive, planetary scale crises that we're facing right now. The market is not going to do it. The market encourages some things well, entrepreneurial activity at a local level, et cetera, but it does not shift the resources in a necessary fashion to address this kind of major threat. Is it going to be done by private foundations? No. I mean, private foundations have a certain amount of money, yes, Gates Foundation, et cetera, but I don't see them marshaling enough money or power to address these issues either. It has to take place at the governmental level. So that's why I emphasize.
John Pfeffer, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. My blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
That was, of course, Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction. Those of us of a certain age remember that song well. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. The significant increase in worker productivity that fails to translate into better wages for workers is not just a U.S., but a worldwide phenomenon. This phenomenon is not actually necessitated by any iron law of capitalist accumulation, but is rather justified by a smokescreen of neoliberal ideology. Today I'm going to read excerpts from an article entitled, "The Harder You Work, the Richer They Get, Wages, Profits, and Productivity," by Pete Dolak. Like many before him, Dolak argues that increased wages, including raising the minimum wage to $15, rather than stifling economic recovery, would stimulate that recovery. "It's not just your imagination," Dolak begins. "You are working harder and earning less. Despite significant productivity gains during the past four decades, wages have remained flat. This is a global phenomenon, not one specific to any country. It's not a matter of the viciousness of this or that capitalist or the policy of this or that government. Rather, widening inequality flows naturally from the ideological construct that now dominates economic thinking. Consider Henry Giroux's succinct definition of neoliberalism. It construes profit-making as the essence of democracy, consuming as the only operable form of citizenship, and an irrational belief in the market to solve all problems and serve as a model for structuring all social relations," end quote. Freedom is reduced to the freedom of industrialists and financiers to extract the maximum possible profit with no regard for any other considerations, and for the rest of us to choose whatever flavor of soda we wish to drink. Having wrested for themselves a real great deal of freedom, the world's capitalists have given themselves salaries, bonus, stock options, and golden parachutes beyond imagination, while ever larger numbers of working people find themselves struggling to keep their heads above water. On the one hand, U.S. chief executive officers earned 354 times more than the average worker in 2013. And even with the bloated pay of top executives and the money siphoned off by financiers, there is still plenty of cash on hand. U.S. publicly traded companies are sitting on a composite hoard of $5 trillion, five times the total during the mid-1990s. On the other hand, there is a much different fortunes of working people. A study of four decades of wage trends in the United States, for example, revealed that the median hourly wage is less than two-thirds of what it would be had it kept pace with productivity gains. Authors Lawrence Michel and Kerry Fagee, writing for the spring 2012 edition of the International Productivity Monitor, calculated the extraordinary mismatch between productivity gains and wages. Their study found that during the 1973 to 2011 period, the real median hourly wage in the United States increased 4%, yet labor productivity rose 80.4%. If the real median hourly wage had grown at the same rate as labor productivity, it would have been $27.87 in 2011, considerably more than the actual $16.07. End quote. Almost every penny of the income generated by that extra work went into the pockets of high-level executives and financiers, not to the employees whose sweat produced it. Wage erosion is at work in Europe as well. A Resolution Foundation paper found a differential between productivity and wage gains for British working people, although smaller than that of the United States. It also found that British workers do not lose as much ground as did French, German, Italian, and Japanese workers. That conclusion is based on a finding that the share of gross domestic product going to wages in those countries has steeply declined since the mid-1970s. Despite the overwhelming evidence of increasing hardship for so many people, economic orthodoxy insists we scream in horror at the very thought of raising wages. Such screaming is based on ideology, not on facts. Low-wage workers in the United States earn far less today than they did in 1968, despite their having a much higher level of education now as compared with then. The federal minimum wage is 23% lower than it was in 1968 when adjusted for inflation. Household spending accounts for 69% of the U.S. gross domestic product. Persistent unemployment and stagnant or falling wages can only lead to continuing economic weakness. Demand is what creates jobs. Raising wages, which in turn would stimulate demand, would, in logical world, appear to be the one route to ameliorating stagnation. In fact, a strong consensus exists that contrary to what the 1% and their higher propagandists say, raising the minimum wage would be beneficial. The National Employment Law Project reports a strong consensus in favor of increasing the minimum wage. The opinion of the economist profession on the impact of the minimum wage has shifted significantly over the past 15 years. Today, the most rigorous research shows little evidence of job reductions from a higher minimum wage. Indicative is a 2013 survey by the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, in which leading economists agreed by nearly 4-to-1 margin that the benefits of raising and indexing the minimum wage outweigh the costs. Two decades of rigorous economic research have found that raising the minimum wage does not result in job loss. While the simplistic theoretical model of supply and demand suggests that raising wages reduces jobs, the way the labor market functions in the real world is more complex. Researchers and businesses alike agree today that the weight of evidence shows no reduction in employment resulting from minimum wage increases. One of the demands of the March on Washington in 1963 was a minimum wage of $2 an hour. Adjusted for inflation, $2 an hour in 1963 would be worth $15.35 today. Yet the federal minimum wage in the United States is $7.25 an hour, and the highest minimum wage mandated by any state government is Washington's $9.32 an hour. The $10.10 an hour, lately proposed by the Obama administration, sounds like an improvement when compared with current rates, but in reality is the usual crumbs on offer by the Democratic Party. The White House is proposing two-thirds of what was demanded 50 years ago. Rather than settle for the Democrats' austerity light, a growing movement is demanding the minimum wage be increased to $15 an hour. When a broader perspective is used, drawing on historical demands, as noted above, that the median hourly wage should be around $28 an hour, the tired arguments that businesses can't afford any raise to minimum wage fall apart. Individualistic ideology promoting the idea of personal responsibility for unemployment, low wages, and economic insecurity is a crucial prop holding up the system that leads to such disastrous results. There are no individual solutions to structural inequality. That was an article entitled "The Harder You Work, the Richer They Get" by Pete Dolak. Dolak writes the Systematic Disorder blog. He has been an activist with many groups. 2 years ago, a few dozen community members in Aravaca, Arizona, came together to confront the militarization of their town along the U.S.-Mexico border. They formed a grassroots organization called People Helping People, with the aim of providing humanitarian aid to migrants in this border zone, but also of dismantling the checkpoints in this militarized zone. Sophie Smith, a Borderlands organizer, actively involved with People Helping People, now talks with Jan Hawken about the scene in Aravaca and the campaigns underway this spring.
Welcome to KBOO, Sophie Smith.
Thanks so much for having me, Jan.
Well, as anyone who follows Arizona immigration politics knows, the journey across that border for migrants is very risky, and many die in the desert canyons after the exhausting journey across the mountains. And there are a number of human rights groups providing humanitarian aid to migrants, but there is a community in southern Arizona, the People Helping People, that is actually fighting back around the militarizing of the border. And you've been involved for several years in that organization, People Fighting. I will start to say People Fighting People, but maybe on some level also apt. People Helping People. And specifically, you're going to be talking today about their campaign around checkpoints. But could you first tell us something about, describe the town in the region,
sure,
in this area of the borderlands, and where it is in relation to the what's called the migration corridor?
Mm-hmm. Well, Aravaca is a town of about 700 people lying, I think, 11 miles north of the physical line between the U.S. and Mexico, northwest of the port of entry in Nogales, Arizona, Sonora. And the town of Aravaca, it's a rural town in the basin of a huge hills and mountainous desert region. And I think the story there in terms of the campaign sort of starts in the mid-1990s when neoliberal economic reforms, as we now know them, catalyzed a mass population transfer north, and border enforcement changed their strategy in response to this huge increase in migration flows, to direct those crossing into the U.S. without papers into remote, mountainous desert regions of the border and away from conventional ports of entry in cities. So what that looked like was building walls around in Tijuana and in Nogales and building up enforcement initially in urban crossings that would then funnel migration traffic through the desert. And Aravaca is in that desert. It's sort of the first sign of civilization if walking through that desert. So that started in the mid-1990s. And then after 9/11, with the consolidation of the Department of Homeland Security, which absorbed INS and absorbed a lot of the enforcement functions of the drug war into the war on terror, the town of Aravaca, as well as many, many other border communities, saw a massive arrival of border enforcement infrastructure, which looked like helicopters in the sky, agents on the ground, towers, surveillance towers, and just a huge enforcement presence, which at this point amounts to more or less a military occupation of the area. I mean, Aravaca is an area where migration enforcement stages, and with that kind of perpetual influx, which is always increasing, of enforcement infrastructure to the area, we saw the delivery of a system of inland checkpoints to southern Arizona.
Is that part of what's meant by the borderlands? It's a term that has been taken up as an area of study, mm-hmm. but also carries, encompasses a kind of political and moral geography around what's meant by a border. It's not, as you said earlier, just the physical boundary that sure. people associate with crossing into a port of entry, but
right.
but also something about the interdependency of people and a more ambiguous terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just say a bit about that term?
Sure.
That may not be familiar to everyone.
Well, I think that the kind of conventional vision of the border that's projected into the, at least the national imagination, is one of a border wall or of a river. You know, some demarcation of a line in the sand that then gets built up in some way,
and that has a kind of naturalness to it in a way.
Sure, or some assertion of sovereignty. And I think that what is obscured in that vision of the border is the way in which the real terrain of border enforcement at this point is a massive massive area of the desert on the U.S. side, and that. Through the implementation of inland checkpoints north of the physical line, as much as 70 or 80 miles north, and as we see in Texas, there's now an enormous zone that's captured kind of within the hold of militarized border enforcement, where we witness more or less the functioning of a police state, and with it that captures border communities that. Have been there, long before something like the North American Free Trade Agreement was implemented. So the border lands is in a way a way of talking about the existence of life and communities within the border region. And I think border zone is a way to articulate how those lands become converted into a weapon of militarization at this moment.
That also forges a sense of common interests that perhaps go beyond humanitarian aid to strangers passing through, vulnerable strangers, but mm-hmm. also kind of a common set of interests. And some of those converge at the checkpoints. Can you describe what happens at the checkpoint in Aravaca?
Well, so the... Like I mentioned, along with the project of militarization came these inland checkpoints in Arizona. I think there are 11, there might be 13. I'm not entirely sure, but
many of them.
There are many of them, and they're on all major throughways in the area. And I think that perhaps and what they appear as are road blockades, where any vehicle traveling through has to stop. And so when I go through the checkpoint, I drive up, and in Aravaca, the checkpoint is a rural checkpoint on a rural highway. So there's really nothing around except for desert and a few armed Border Patrol agents waiting to stop you. And depending on who you are and what day it is and what agent you encounter, a lot of different things can happen there. For me, as a allegedly white person with citizenship status, I am often waved through either without questioning or simply asked if I'm a U.S. citizen, and I say yes. And sometimes I'm subjected to a lot more questioning, and sometimes I'll find myself pulled over in the secondary inspection area with a dog sniffing my car and a lot of hassle. And it's extremely unpredictable what happens at these checkpoints for people of color in general, Latino people in particular. There is excessive questioning, a lot more profiling that happens there. And the function of these checkpoints is, in name, it's to inspect cars for immigration violations, vehicles carrying either concealed people or people without papers traveling through, or also it's sort of part of an unofficial part of the drug war as well. But in practice, really, this isn't a place where apprehensions are happening. By positioning checkpoints on all roads significantly north of the line with Mexico, it means that those crossing through the deserts with through the desert without papers have to walk an enormous distance in order to get to a point that they could get a ride into the interior of the United States. So in Aravaca, the checkpoints are about 23, 25 miles north of the line. So you can imagine that that's a multi-day journey through a very harsh geography. So I think in that sense, the checkpoints serve as a punitive function, as a way to manage and punish migration entering in the U.S., entering into the U.S. without papers. And then from a residential perspective in the borderlands, I think it's really a form of surveillance of the local community. It's a way to profile the local community and to seal off communities south of that system within a really different terrain of enforcement and system of civil rights, and to create a zone that's really apart in a lot of ways from, I think, the kind of policing that, that we see in a lot of areas of the U.S. interior.
So in the campaign to make the checkpoints a thing of the past, does that end up being kind of a skirmish or a struggle between these low-level border patrol agents out there in the desert, acting on, as a power, as a presence of the state, but pretty low in the whole hierarchy of homeland security, for sure. How do you move beyond kind of skirmishes with border control agents at these checkpoints to this, to a larger political set of interests? What are you trying to achieve, or what is the community trying to achieve through monitoring the checkpoints?
Well, I think that the campaign comes from an observation by residents that this whole system of border enforcement really relies on the complacency and obedience of the local population. And as people living in the region, living in the middle of human struggles for survival and human tragedy, and under a very explicit police state, I think there is a frustration, and you know, people are tired and wanting to refuse that role of kind of the obedient bystander to all of this drama that's really affecting everyone in the region. So I think
part of it, sort of a shift from the threat of the alien outsider coming into your community to the threat of the border patrol apparatus itself. Sort of that's important in the strategy, a shift the defining of the threat.
Right. And I think that it's noticing that residents are in a unique position to challenge these policies by having citizenship, the privilege of citizenship status in the area, and that their role is largely undetermined. And they could easily, you know, in another setting go the way of just being collaborators with law enforcement. I think that residents are saying no. And the campaign has really been an appeal to the power structure. It started with a petition to the Border Patrol Tucson Sector Chief to remove the checkpoint. So it really wasn't about skirmishes at the checkpoint. It was about getting a majority of the community on board, and about a third of the local population signed this petition to demand the removal of the checkpoint. And it was delivered ceremoniously in December in a big march to the checkpoint.
And there's a video of that that's quite riveting. Yeah, on the people helping people
website online. Yeah, it was a very exciting day, I will say. People really turned out, and it was a big community event. We occupied the checkpoint, and it closed down for the day without that being a goal whatsoever.
It was a very important symbolic victory.
Right.
Just in closing, how unique is Aravaca and this organization? How does it relate to a broader anti-militarization movement, and perhaps a movement that has as its aim dismantling borders as well as checkpoints?
Well, I think Aravaca is unfortunately not at all unique in the problems that are facing residents there. I think, you know, just to the west of town is the Tohono O'odham Reservation, which has its own checkpoints and its own struggles that are, in a lot of ways, are even more acute. And there's border communities all along the southern border with Mexico. that are facing these problems. So checkpoint monitoring, which is what's happening right now in the campaign, is definitely being talked about in other border communities, and we're seeing a ripple effect. So I think it's a really exciting time for border communities to take a position.
And we can follow that activity and support it both financially and through volunteer work through the website. It's important and fascinating and kind of a dramatically unfolding story.
Right.
The website is?
The website is www.phparavaca.org, and we are fundraising right now to fund equipment for checkpoint monitoring campaign costs. So if you're able to go on there and watch videos and also donate, that would be great.
Yeah. Thanks so much,
Thank
Sophie
you,
Smith,
Thanks
for
so
being
much
here
for
with
me.
Us today.
Aquí estoy establecido en los Estados Unidos. 10 años pasaron ya. En que crucé de mojado y papeles no he arreglado. Sigo siendo un ilegal. Tengo mi esposa y mis hijos que me los traje muy chicos y se han olvidado.
That was a song about the migrant experience by the group Los Tigres del Norte, entitled La Jaula de Oro, The Golden Cage. I can't translate all the lyrics, but to give you non-Spanish speakers an idea, the last verse goes like this. What's money good for if I live like a prisoner? In this great nation, when I'm reminded of this, I cry. Although this cage is made of gold, it's still a prison. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Concluding our program, Bill Resnick shares a piece from Counterpunch on Venezuela, which discusses how the big food merchants are withholding food from the market to destabilize the government and make it appear that the government is running the country into the ground. Bill?
Thanks, Tom. Another cage. This one not a golden cage in Venezuela. I'm Bill Resnick. I'll be reading from an article on Venezuela titled Deep Down in Venezuela, Capital Won't Let the People Go. It's in the web journal Counterpunch this week. The article discusses how Venezuelan big business is working to destabilize the Venezuelan economy and bring down the government. After the reading, I'll comment on how big business operates in the U.S., somewhat differently, but for the same goal, to control the economy and government and, in fact, bend people to its will. First, I'll set the scene. The current government in Venezuela is led by Nicolas Maduro, who was elected in a special election when Hugo Chavez died. The Maduro-led government campaigned on a program of continuing the policies of the Chavez coalition. That is, they want to raise wages and social protections for the poor majority. Also, to improve and empower poor communities by providing public funds to popular elected assemblies that operate democratically, coming together after a good deal of discussion to make decisions. They generally choose to use the money to build clean water systems, also money for transit and parks. And to do that, the Maduro government, but previously the Chavez government, used Venezuelan oil money. And also by taxing the rich, which of course is a new thing for the rich in Venezuela, who mostly escape most taxes. Anyway, this taxing the rich does not sit well with Venezuelan big business, who set out to destabilize the government through sabotaging the economy. Chris Gilbert, who teaches in Venezuela, describes how they are doing that. It's actually pretty easy. They withhold food, let the shelves in their markets go bare. Then a day or two later, they deliver a big load of food that is quickly exhausted by a great flood of hungry people, willing to pay very high prices to stock up for the next period of shortage. Gilbert explains how big business can do that, and I quote him. Here he is, Chris Gilbert. "Because big business has the means of production in their hands, that capitalists, or rather that social class, can legally kill 1,000 poor souls by simply not hiring them, or can legally make 1 million go hungry by just raising prices or cutting production. Alongside this kind of despotic economic power, mere political power can seem pathetic and trifling." Gilbert continues, "Today in Venezuela, the capitalist class is in action, trying to discipline the institutions of political power, which, with Chavez, escaped a bit from their usually restricted field of operation. The government, the Maduro government, which feels cornered, calls the opposition's activity economic warfare. But the truth is that this is just business as usual for the capitalist class, speculating, playing with prices, tinkering with supply and demand. That's not, strictly speaking, a perversion of capitalism, but an integral part thereof. Desperately, the government complains about street blocking and other forms of violent protest." Those are all going on in Venezuela. It's a full-court press trying to destroy the government. "The government tries to make visible the difficult situation and its faceless enemy by pointing to the violence, which is overt and illegal." That is the street blocking and the killings. "But the real problem is elsewhere, in the completely legal form of economic violence sanctioned by the empire of law. In fact, big business knows that unless President Maduro opts, as he is very unlikely to do, for the most radical heresy, which is deny the sacredness of private property and take those groceries and the whole distributing apparatus over, that can't be done, however, by Maduro. It would incur the wrath of the capitalist class around the planet, who will cry communist, and then cripple the Venezuelan economy by refusing to trade with Venezuela and imposing sanctions and seizing assets and stopping bank transfers. So Maduro can't seize the groceries, and Venezuelan big business retains the upper hand and is creating anxiety all over the country, and especially among the government supporters, who don't have the money to stock up on provisions. Conclude, that's what's now happening in Venezuela. The big business again has conspired to destabilize the country by making food scarce and erratic and expensive. That, however, is not the way big business does things here. If they did, the chief conspirators would be arrested and the company sued in antitrust for damages, indeed treble damages. So that's not open to them. But big business, capital, does keep control here. How do they do it here? To begin, they do not threaten to make food scarce. It's not the grocers or retailers who do the heavy lifting. The real work of political control is done by the largest private employers, with help from the major developers, who threaten that they will have to carefully consider leaving the city if candidate XY is elected or some policy like raising corporate taxes enacted. The businessmen of the business alliance of any city will tell cooperative TV stations and newspapers that they support having good schools and parks and transit environmental protection. But if you raise our taxes, we'll have to carefully consider any one of the numerous letters and contacts we receive from other cities, states, and even countries who would love to have us and have offered us tax breaks. And you know, we have to meet the competition. This is severe international competition. We have to be efficient and effective. Even the real estate people chime in to say that a number of big companies are considering coming here, but not if the city or state raises taxes or even eliminates one of the tax breaks for big companies. Let's say a candidate is running on a platform of good schools, more parks, a clean environment, affordable housing, decent places to live for the homeless. And let's say he or she proposes to pay for that by taxing the rich and business. What would happen? What does happen? These companies raise lots of money to say the candidate is bad for business, that she or he will drive out many employers and ruin the local economy, and that is a kiss of death for any candidate for most U.S. North Americans, because most U.S. North Americans have something to lose and have seen what happens to communities when the employers start leaving. How then does capital call them big business? How do they rule? Not because of the campaign finance system, not because politicians need big corporate money for their campaigns, though donations do buy access in the competition between various industries for tax breaks and other government-bestowed favors. But how do they really rule here? Because they have the power to destroy any candidate, any political coalition that crosses them, that calls for them to contribute to the common good. Of course, that is a very troublesome fact. If freeing governments from corporate rule is not primarily through reforms in campaign finance, which in itself is a hard thing to do, then what is to be done? Well, the answer, of course, is build movements. It's worked in the past. It will work again. Entrenched capital's interests have been defeated. And we'll talk more about that in coming shows.
Thanks, Bill. That concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Next week, in a somewhat satirical acknowledgement of Earth Day, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Joe Clement will discuss the current biblical blockbuster, Noah. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll be back. We'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is George Bosch, founder of the Himalayan Stove Project, which has installed more than 3,000 high-efficiency, clean-burning stoves in impoverished homes across remote, mountainous regions of Nepal. And at 11, it's Health Watch with host David Naiman. Today's guest is Dr. Mark Hyman, author of the book The 10-Day Detox Diet, which aims squarely at controlling blood glucose and insulin levels. And that's it for today's program.
This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, March 14th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on the radio, and of course, KBOO.FM on the web. This is, of course, your community radio. And starting right out, we have a number of headlines to talk about, and as we've got information also for you on a total lunar eclipse that's taking place. It begins around 10-ish this evening and climaxes, so to speak, at midnight. It's a great eclipse for those who are chronically ill-equipped for such events, because if were it a solar eclipse, you'd have to wear the special glasses and run down to OMSI and so forth. But this is a lunar eclipse, and you can go out and stare at it to your heart's content. Interestingly enough, it starts anyway on 4/14/2014, and these things don't come around often, and it's worth staying up late for it. But starting out, though, through making our way through the headlines, why Oregon is special in that special sense. The road to Damascus is a weird and winding one. House Bill 4029, which passed last month, allows any property on the boundary and within a half a mile from another city to leave Damascus. That means a private, you know, citizen, your house, your household, you can decide that you're leaving Damascus. At least 17 people have seized the opportunity to leave Damascus. This de-annexization exodus has only just begun, and it's quite a turnaround from 2004, when Damascus, that's just southeast of Portland, of course, became one of Oregon's newest cities. Residents hope to control their own destiny amid urban expansion, hence the craziness. And the fading gas tax. And ODOT's road woes are only beginning. People are driving less. Their vehicles have become more fuel efficient, right? While those might be considered positive trends, a potential decline in gas tax revenues is one reason. The Oregon Department of Transportation says that it's on track to spend about $500 million less on construction in 2020 than during the peak of the stimulus in 2009. That, of course, remember the good old stimulus that was supposed to be spent on our crumbling infrastructure. There is a simple solution, though, out there. Abolish a gas tax completely and replace it with a weight tax. We'd raise more money that way and discourage the massive trucks and their mega loads from tearing up the tarmac. People who wanted to load up those huge logging trucks with old-growth forests might think twice if it was going to be a nosebleed to pay the weight tax. So no more gas tax, because no more gas, eh? But there's plenty of weight moving down our roads and doing a great deal more damage than anything else out there. So it's a thought. You wonder why these people aren't somehow screened out before they can do lasting public damage. A former police lieutenant who led the Southern Oregon High-Tech Crimes Task Force has been charged with official misconduct and computer crime. Well, of course he has. He was the guy that was in charge of high-tech crime. So, of course, he knows how to commit high-tech crimes. Yes, Josh Mullen was arraigned last Friday in Jackson County Circuit Court. A felony charge outlined in the indictment alleges that Mullen altered, damaged, or destroyed a computer or software, while the misdemeanor charge alleges that he knowingly used, accessed, or attempted to access computer software data, blah, blah, blah. The official misconduct charge alleges that Mullen illegally used his position as a public servant while committing the crimes, according to the indictment. Well, wait a minute. Wait, hold on. This guy, it is very, very, I checked on this, very unlikely that this guy is going to do any time at all. He'll probably lose his job. right? But he's not going to jail. In fact, he has nothing to fear. In fact, if he did have something to fear, he would have fled to Russia by now or be seeking asylum in some other welcoming country. Because, you know, what this guy did is exactly the same sort of thing as Edward Snowden did. By the way, Edward Snowden's up for the Pulitzer Prize this year, which is something I don't think that Josh Mullen's future holds out for him. But nonetheless, messing around with computers these days has, like every other sort of crime, has a sliding scale when it comes to jail time. Some people can expect a great deal more retribution than others. And as for Josh Mullen, well, good luck, Josh. You'll soon be back in your police uniform. And you wonder, another sign that the nation's infrastructure is showing some serious infra fractures, Wenapum Dam on the Columbia River is just one example. It's showing a little crackage these days. And this is just one of many aging public projects that are feeling the effects of time. The consequent reduction of water levels at the dam have prompted crews to carry out about $7 million worth of work on fish ladders for Chinook salmon. Now, let's remember, let's think carefully about this. Fish ladders are not part of Chinook salmon habitat. We have destroyed Chinook salmon habitat. When you destroy the habitat of a creature, the creature is dead. They're zombies. It's the walking dead. And unless the habitat is restored, which in some cases is difficult, if not impossible to accomplish, that species is in fact extinct. A few still may be scrambling up the ladders, but nonetheless, it's extinct. Let's just get over ourselves and use that word. The salmon are extinct. We've destroyed their habitat. So all the ladders and putting fish on trucks and driving them all over the country, none of that is going to save anything except our own fragile self-esteem as a culture, as a society. However, returning to Wenapum Dam, the consequent reduction of water levels have prompted crews to carry out all of this.